From the stuff your mother never told you to the stuff your doctor never learned, On Health is what happens when a midwife plus a Yale-trained MD shares about all things women's health, from periods to menopause, sex to reproductive health politics, motherhood to mental health. Join me for taboo-busting conversations that demystify and destigmatize our bodies, all while bridging the gap between conventional medicine and wellness. Along the way, we'll be exploring the science and wisdom of how our bodies work, what makes us well, what gets in the way, and how we can live our best lives on our terms. When it comes to women's health and well-being, there's nothing we won't talk about. The new medicine for women is here. I'm Dr. Aviva Ram. Welcome to the podcast. Hey, everybody, and welcome to On Health. My guest today is on a mission to empower women to take charge of their health. And she is part of a deep legacy of women who have paved the way for others, as you'll learn about. Born in Mobile, Alabama, Dr. Sharon Malone is the youngest of eight children and was raised by her siblings after the death of her mother. She moved multiple times during childhood, changing schools four times in 4 years in three states. She found strength and resilience in community, in her own work ethic, and in her strong belief that there are no accidents in the universe. She went on to graduate cum laude from Harvard, then with honors from Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, and completed her residency at the George Washington University School of Medicine and served women across DC in her almost 30 years of practicing as an OB-GYN. With appearances on the Michelle Obama podcast, Oprah Winfrey's The Life You Want, The Today Show, and more, Dr. Malone is a nationally known expert in women's health and a vocal advocate for menopause awareness and evidence-based information about hormone replacement therapy. A certified menopause practitioner, she believes that all women should be able to make decisions regarding their health and quality of life based on facts, not fear. Her first book, Grown Woman Talk, Your Guide to Getting and Staying Healthy, about which her dear personal friend, Michelle Obama, says, a must read for anyone who cares about their quality of life. Dr. Sharon Malone is the first person I turn to for a whole host of issues, especially my health. But I have to say, when I got your copy of your book, I was like, damn, this girl scooped me. And I'll tell you why. Because I was set writing up a proposal for a menopause book. And my idea was to have every chapter start with a disco R&B or soul song. So I was like, really? Yeah, I'm going to have like Hot in Here, which of course is rap. And I'm going to have like We Are Family for the importance of connection. And I was going to have Disco Inferno. And I got your book and I was like, all right, I already love her, but no fair.
See, great minds though. That's what that's all about. Great minds.
I know. Well, I love your book. It's so personal. And I have to say, I'm not a usual fangirl crush person, but you are incredible, formidable woman. My husband was like, oh, I kind of am a big fan of her husband. And then when I read about your sister, I was like, seriously? And I told my husband who your sister was, and he was a history teacher, and we were both just kind of like a bit dropped to our knees. So it's a real honor to have you here today. And I, as we're talking, I know family and your female ancestral line is so important to you. I just want to honor and invite those ancestors in with us and thank them for you being here today.
You are so kind. And you know what? And I think it's befitting. This is Women's History mm-hmm. Month. And I just left Alabama on Friday. And I was down there with a group of midwives and doulas and birth workers. Yes. You know, if you have not heard of her, you have got to follow this woman, Michelle Browder, who runs the Anarka Betsy Lucy Foundation in Alabama. And, you know, and so she convenes this conference every, you know, this is the third year. And I went down, she's got these amazing monuments, that are just breathtaking, to Anarka Betsy and Lucy to sort of counteract the J. Marion Sims statue, which is still on the state grounds of the Alabama state capitol, unfortunately. But she is down there doing the Lord's work and really trying to get the mothers in Alabama, the maternal health care that they need.
Yeah, so critical. I spent my midwifery training partly in Roxbury, Massachusetts, training with a traditional Black Muslim midwife who is Shafia Monroe. She's kind of one of the grandmothers of midwifery in the country. And then in Atlanta, largely in the Black community, mentored by a midwifery collective called Dua Afe, and had the opportunity to give testimony to the legislature there during COVID and by Zoom. And it's like, come on, y'all, we're still like hovering at the bottom of maternal mortality, infant mortality statistics here. And, you know, when I was in med school, I mean, it wasn't that long ago, it was the early 2000s. I was a midwife for 20 years before, so I was in med school in my late 30s. And we had an OB class, and the OB teaching us said, and I want to talk about the godfather of obstetrics, J. Marion Sims. And I was like, excuse me, let's reframe here and talk about Anarcha and Lucy and Betsy. For those of you listening, they were enslaved women who were either brought to or bought by this physician who experimented on them relentlessly without anesthesia. And, you know, there's so many tropes we could talk about, Sharon, the trope of the Black woman who doesn't feel pain and doesn't need anesthesia. But there's quite a nefarious history to obstetrics and gynecology in this country.
There is. And you know what the shameful thing is that I'm an OBGYN and I've practiced for over 30 years. And I knew of J. Marion Sims just as, you know, he's credited as being the father of gynecology. Never knew that sordid history until Charlottesville, when they started, you know, investigating and taking down some of these Confederate monuments. And I found out that, wow, just in my home state, not only did J. Marion Sims come there and do these atrocious things, but he left and went to New York, which was where I trained in medical school and founded the first women's hospital. So he brought all those terrible things that he learned in Alabama and brought them with him to New York. And New York responded and took his monument down in Central Park, and it still is there on the state ground of Alabama. So,
yeah, I mean, this is such a powerful entry to a conversation around so many aspects of what you're doing, what I'm doing, and kind of leads into some of the complicated issues we face in how women have been marginalized and silenced in our healthcare. And I want to talk about that and hear your thoughts and how this has kind of shifted your revelations as an OB-GYN. But if you don't mind, your story is so, it feels like it's so important to your history of how you even became an OB-GYN. And I was very drawn to the story of your mom for two reasons. One, what influence she had and her life and death and her relationship with the medical system had on you, and how maybe that inspired your journey. And just of note on a little personal thing, aside from the disco inferno, is that your mom was Bertha Davis and my great-grandmother was Bertha David. So I think I'll always remember your mother's name.
Oh my goodness. See, I'm telling you, there are no accidents in the universe. So we were supposed to meet and share stories.
Yeah. So you lost your mom when you were really young. And, you know, I wonder how much that sometimes influences us to go into caring for mothers, right? But what was the influence of her life and death and healthcare relationship with you on your journey?
Yeah, you know what? It's funny, when being back in Alabama brought a lot of things back up to the surface for me. And I talk about the street that I grew up on, and I literally lived next door to not one but two hospitals. And the hospital that I could throw a rock at was the old Marine Hospital, which was built in the 1850s. And it, you know, functioned as a hospital during the Civil War. And then right next door to that hospital was the old Mobile General, which was a city hospital. And probably three blocks to the south was the first medical school that was founded in the state of Alabama. And it was founded by a doctor who moved there, I think from Philadelphia, and his name was Dr. Josias Knott. And his claim to fame, not only that he founded the first medical school, but he was one of the experts who lectured around the country on the inferiority of Black people. And he, you know, when they did this whole thing with the phrenology where they measured skulls, so they had a, he had a scientific basis for why Black people were inferior. So whether I knew it or not, there was always this medical sort of spirit that existed on the street that I grew up in. But I think that what really got me thinking about this was that we had no real relationship with doctors growing up. My mother grew up in the rural parts of Alabama in a part called the Black Belt. And, you know, medical care was inaccessible to Black people and to most people anyway who lived in the rural South. And so not having that sort of history of a relationship and particularly positive relationships with doctors was something that I think always sort of kept in my head of something I wanted to make better for the next generation. And I didn't want people and women in particular to die of things that I have only come to as an adult to know that they're preventable and treatable. And my mother died at 57 of colon cancer, which we all know that can be easily diagnosed early and treated. But in the 1970s, it just wasn't a thing.
What a powerful legacy to be surrounded by medicine, but not be using it and accessing it. Do you have a sense, was it financial resources? Was it just being healthy? Was it home remedies? Or was it fear of engaging with the medical model that kept your family a little bit out of using?
I think it's all of the above. You know, because to be able to instill good habits, and I have to tell you, my mother couldn't have been a healthier person, you know, just of the things that she did. She, you know, she worked hard. My dad had a vegetable garden right next door to our house. Now, I don't know what was in the soil there, but we grew and ate farm to table before that was even a thing. But she grew up on a farm, so they always had fresh fruits, fresh vegetables. You know, they didn't eat, you couldn't eat out of season. So, and she was a healthy person. But the problem is that when there are things and what we call these social determinants of health, she had no history of having interacted with a doctor favorably, you know, not having the economic resources, even when one was available, and just not being part of your, you know, that's not even a thing. People didn't go to the doctor unless you were ill. There was no such thing as preventative care. And that's sort of how we were raised.
Supplements can be an important way to fill the gaps in our nutrition and can sometimes be a missing link in what conventional medicine doesn't have to offer. When it comes to a whole host of health concerns we face as women and mothers, finding supplements we can trust isn't always easy. Studies show us that sometimes what we think we're getting isn't actually what's in the bottle. Enter Fullscript, the company I use to meet my own, my family's, and my patients' supplements needs. With over 300 professional quality products carefully curated to meet our needs from preconception to postpartum, menstrual health to menopause, and our overall wellness, and for products for our children and our partners too. Fullscript attests to the quality of their products. Getting you as close as possible to what the products say is on the package. And I'm committed to bringing these to you more affordably. If you use the link avivaram.com/supplements, you'll find an automatic 15% discount on every order. And because my work is mission-driven, I make a percentage of profits available to organizations improving maternal health. Don't worry, you'll find the links in the show notes. Join me in getting better nutritional and herbal supplements for you and yours, while doing good for mamas and babies too.
And I think my mother also didn't have the knowledge of what was even a warning sign. You know, perhaps, I'm sure she had symptoms well before she died, but she didn't know that that was something that she should have gone to the doctor for. And when she finally did engage, it was too late. And I still remember, and we're coming up on some very important days because tomorrow, if she were alive, would be her 110th birthday.
Wow.
I am a perimenopause baby. So for those of you out there who think, oh yeah, you can't get pregnant when you're in your 40s. Yes, you can. And I'm living proof of that. My mother, I'm sure, was hoping for menopause and she got me instead. So, you know, well, lucky for me.
Right. She just probably thought she was missing some periods because she was in the change of life, right?
Exactly.
So you grew up in a powerful family in terms of education being really prioritized. And when I mentioned earlier, kind of us being jaw dropped and brought to our knees when we realized who your sister was, Vivian Malone Jones, tell us about her. And when I was looking her up as I was reading your story and I saw the picture of her entering University of Alabama, I was like, oh my gosh, I mean, I've seen that picture so many times. Yeah. Can you just share a little bit about your sis?
Sure. Well, let me tell you a little bit about my family generally, because, you know, we don't have these kind of families anymore. I am the youngest of eight children. So my oldest brother is 23 years older than me. So we are three boys. Every 2 years, my mother had, so I have a brother who's now 86, one who's 88, and one who, if he were alive, would be 84. And my sister was the first girl. And you can imagine being the first girl growing up with three brothers, you know, she had a hard way to go. So by the time she got to this point where she was challenging the governor of Alabama, then Governor Wallace, I think she was well armored to be able to have that fight. But here's the problem. And I think that something that everyone should be aware of, that this is not an isolated event. My family, I am a sixth generation Alabamian, six generations who have been born and died and sweated and toiled in the soil of Alabama. And until my sister entered the University of Alabama in 1963, that was the first time that anyone in my family, on my mother's and my father's side, was actually able to get an education funded by the state of Alabama in a state institution. And, you know, and this is an ancient history. This was just 1963. And Vivian was the most determined person you will ever meet. She walked into that situation knowing that what she was walking into, and yet she was able to survive it. But let me say this, and this is something I talk about a lot in my book. Sometimes the price you pay for survival is really sublimation. It's stress. It had to have been extremely stressful for her to be in that environment and to kind of take that with you on a day-to-day basis. And I think we all know the detrimental effects that chronic stress has on your body. So even though she did everything she was supposed to do, she made it through, she was the first Black graduate of the University of Alabama in 1965, I think it took a toll on her. And I lost her too early. My mom died at 57 and my sister died at age 63. And I think, you know, you can never prove it, but given what she endured throughout her life, I have to believe that there was something about the stress in her life that really wore her immune system down over the years. And this is really a message that I want to get to people. You know, stress is something, I think she had the perfect storm. You know, she knew she had access to good medical care, and it ultimately didn't matter. She died of a disease that's something that we don't even really know how to diagnose until it's too late. She had myelodysplastic syndrome, which is a leukemia type disease. But you know, I say this to say all these women, you know, and I think the women who lived in Alabama and survived long enough to get the next generation up to speed paid a price. And I wanted to make sure that at least from the little bit I could do to make sure that women got the education and at least the access, because we all know the medical system is not always there for you. They don't always see you in a way that will help you do the things that you need to get done to stay and get healthy.
Thank you for sharing that. I wish it was something we could say was something that we left behind as our cultural legacy, but are you familiar with Arlene Geronimus's work or the term weathering?
Absolutely.
And so sometimes people act so surprised at the maternal mortality rates, the maternal morbidity rates, the hypertension, the preeclampsia, and especially amongst Black women, right? And then we look at these social determinants of health, we look at weathering, because this is the case for Black women who are, as you know, educated, MDs, PhDs, making six and seven figure incomes, still having 5, 7, and 12 times a higher mortality rate in birth than white women who live in the Ozarks and don't even have a high school education. That's not genetics. That's not race, if you will, which is a term I don't love for all the implications it has.
Right.
But it's still these social determinants of health that are impacting women. And then when we look at intersectionality, Black women who are pregnant, and Black women and women who are entering menopause. So I really just appreciate you bringing this up, because I think we look at some of the diseases that are happening in our society and we also blame people, right? Like, oh, if she just ate better, or if she had just had more doctor visits. I mean, the doctor visits might catch something early, but they're not going to prevent the accumulated impact of stress or lack of access to good food or all the things.
You know, that is exactly right. And one of the things I want to do is sort of broaden that aperture to sort of have people see that, yes, the maternal mortality crisis is a crisis, but it extends from cradle to grave when it comes to Black women and poor women and everything in between. Because the same, you know, even though we say, oh, it's 2 to 3 times for Black women, yes, in maternal mortality and infant mortality, but what we don't want to address is that how you enter pregnancy is also a big determinant on how you will do during pregnancy. And the outcomes, the poor outcomes that you have during pregnancy, like preeclampsia, like diabetes, will influence how you do decades after you have completed a pregnancy. And so I think what is distressing to me is, you know, and particularly having practiced obstetrics for as long as I have, is that the things that women are dying from are not new things. We have known, you know, that there's the number one reason why women die either during or after pregnancy is really from cardiovascular diseases. Well, why don't women know that? Why don't women know what the signs are of preeclampsia? If you knew these things, perhaps you would be in a better stead once you were preparing for pregnancy, during pregnancy, such that when things turn up, you don't allow someone to gaslight you and tell you, oh, you're fine. You know, this isn't, you know, late breaking science here. We have known that preeclampsia is a problem, and it's increased in Black women for certainly as long as I've been practicing. And I think the bigger question is not what are women dying from, but why have we not done anything about it? You know, when I started in medical school 36 years ago, oh my God, it was longer than that. Oh, it's almost 40 years ago. Oh, I graduated. We were having the same conversations that we have now. And I think what we have got to really start asking and demanding is, okay, that's the what, why, and more importantly, what are we going to do about it? And I think that we've been just sort of complacent in medicine and just going, oh, preeclampsia, well, I don't know why, you know, and we've let it lie.
And that's the big thing. It's, you know, and I talk about this a lot in my book, Hormone Intelligence, how often we say, well, I don't know why, we don't know why, but we do. We're just, there was a wonderful scientist who passed this past year, Evelyn Fox Keller, and she did a lot of work around women in science. And she said, you only get answers as good as the questions you're asking. And we already have the answers. I'm like, the maternal mortality rates in the state of Georgia are amongst the worst in the country, the infant mortality rates. We have a slew of midwives, white midwives, Black midwives, willing to go all over the state and serve communities. And yet, home birth midwives, direct entry midwives are still illegal. In Georgia, this makes no sense. This is an affordable, educated workforce that also checks off a lot of the boxes of affinity care, right? Like the data that we know that if you have a provider who looks more like you, you're more likely to have better outcomes, right? Black babies have better outcomes in hospital, are more likely to survive if they have a Black pediatrician, or et cetera, et cetera. So, right. There seems to be something more going on than just we don't know why. It's almost like, what are we ignoring and what are the forces that are determining that?
Well, you know, I think that, and this is also a top line message that I want to get out there, is that more women are dying from lack of care than are dying from bad care. And I think that the narrative has been to sort of scare women away from hospitals and from traditional medicine because they think that that is the problem. But the problem is really lack of access. And when you think of all the places where the maternal mortality rate is the highest, it's in the states that it's Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, the places where there are the women who have the highest uninsured rate. They have less access to doctors because the per capita of doctors to patient ratio and patient to doctor ratio is, you know, is ridiculously low. And when you...
Because there's something like 90 counties, 90 entire counties, yes, in Georgia with no hospital, no obstetrician, yes, no midwife.
And as you're closing rural hospitals left and right, what do you think is going to happen? That is certainly not the answer to improving anyone's healthcare. And yet, we keep doing it. And the one avenue that we have to improve, certainly maternal care, is by nurses, midwives, and people who can access patients where they are. You know, I was just at this conference, Michelle Browder, and I think someone else was doing a presentation, and they said, in Alabama, there in certain parts of rural Alabama, the nearest health clinic that you can get to, just the Board of Health type clinic, maybe 35 miles away. The nearest hospital, maybe 57 miles away. And if you don't have a car, it's as if none of it exists. And these are the conditions that, like I said, these are policy decisions that people are making, that legislators are making about their priorities for tax dollars. And if you don't get women the care that they need, and like I said, this is across the board. We're just using the maternal mortality statistics as a proxy for all of it. Hypertension, heart disease, strokes, amputations, you name it. And you can take any of these health outcomes and look at the black-white disparities, and it's going to always be 2 to 3 times more. And even when you look at even poor white people who live in these counties have the same problem. So it's not unique. It's not a race thing. It's always going to be the overlay of race. But the bottom line is that it's just lack of affordable care and healthcare providers for people who need them.
Well said. Applauding here. Yes. It's a manifesto happening here. You mentioned that when women have preeclampsia, hypertension, prenatally, we do know, for example, having gestational diabetes increases your likelihood of diabetes by 50% later in life, or 50% of women will develop it. Let's shift gears to some of these later in life issues. You attended births as an OB, you've been caring for women for 30 years, and you have really recently begun to deeply focus on menopause, and that's a lot of the focus of your new beautiful book. I'm curious, and I'm relating this to myself. I was a midwife for 25 years. I've been a physician for 15 years. And so I know a thing or two about life cycles and hormones and menopause. And I'll tell you, there were some things that surprised me about my own body and sleep and emotional and mental changes as I entered menopause. And I'm 57, so I've been in menopause for a few years now and postmenopausal. How about you? Was there anything surprising to you personally that you experienced that was enlightening, that you knew academically and clinically as a gynecologist, but were like, oh, okay.
You know what? I'm a quick study. Just like I observed women, you know, I delivered babies for years before I actually had one. So going into that experience, I was like, that looks like that's very painful. And it was like, yeah, it is. And the same thing, you know, because when my introduction to menopause really started very early in my career. Typically, you know how when you're a young doctor, you take care of young patients, and then you all sort of progress through the life phases together. But when I started, I inherited a practice from the two older physicians who had actually started our practice. And so from day one, I had 80-year-olds and 18-year-olds. And so I had to get up to speed very quickly on how to manage menopause and menopausal issues. And then what's also different, I think, for younger physicians training now, I practiced for 10 years before the Women's Health Initiative. So our, you know, teaching on menopause and the use of hormones for treatment was very different in the 10 years leading up to the Women's Health Initiative. And we actually were actively prescribing hormones, and not just for the relief of symptoms, because we knew that that worked. That wasn't rocket science. You know, hormones had been around commercially since the 1940s. For the treatment of symptoms of menopause. But we were just getting to the point where we found that cardiovascular disease was decreased in women who took hormones. So when I got to that phase of my life, I was already sort of predisposed to thinking, yes, I know what my family history is. I know what I'm at risk for. So I was already, you know, pretty much in the team hormone group. However, when I got to be perimenopausal, and this hits you right at a time of life where there's just a lot going on. I had three little children. I was still working full-time and delivering babies, and there was just a lot of stress. And even though I was on birth control pills, and I think this is something that women should understand, you think, well, yeah, when you're on birth control pills, it takes care of most of your hormonal symptoms. However, when you have that week off, when you're getting your period and your hormone-free week, then you have free rein to know what your symptoms are like. And my symptoms were, let's say, rage. I mean, I just remember being irrationally angry.
Yeah.
And it was something that's not my basic temperament, but it's the perfect storm. You can't be sleepless and fatigued and having these hormonal issues during perimenopause. And I think if I had to say that was the one thing that really made me know that something really different was happening, was that I would say to myself, now, was that really warranted, you know, in terms of my reaction to things? And things did settle down, but I made a relatively seamless transition, because once I got to be of a certain age, when I was relatively certain that I was indeed menopausal, I just switched from birth control pills to menopausal hormone therapy. And I'm not afraid or ashamed to say I've been on hormone therapy now for 15 years. I'm now 65, and I don't mind saying that either. And let me say this about menopause, because I think it's also important to model behavior. It's not dreaded. It's not something that, oh my God, it's menopause, it's so horrible. I have never been happier and I think more productive about the things that matter to me. And I think for many of us, as we are transitioning, and particularly when we're that sandwich generation, we spend a lot of time building our careers, raising families, spouses, parents, everything is sort of directed outward, you know? And once you get to, if you live long enough to have the privilege of being a woman of a certain age and your kids are grown and a lot of your responsibilities and the things you just don't care so much about anymore, that's a beautiful time. You get to focus on the things that matter to you. And so I want to give, you know, all young women who are either transitioning, look, and trust me, you will, even if you're not now, that's the one thing about menopause, it's not optional, it will happen, is to give you an idea that there is a beacon of light and hope at the end of this whole thing. It's not the end of things, it's the beginning of things. And it's the beginning of a time when you should be able to focus on you. So I don't want to be the voice of doom and gloom for menopause, but here's the thing. If you are bothered by the symptoms of menopause, and there are many of them, but women have a lot of emotional and mental symptoms that go along, from depression to anxiety to rage, to just feeling poorly, and those things are getting in the way of you being your best self, and this is a time that you're going to spend 30 to 40% of your remaining years, then what I say to you is you need to go get that addressed. Because, you know, for those who say, oh, Dr. Malone, you're pro-hormones, and I'm not pro-hormones. I am anti-suffering.
I love it. I say the same thing to my patients. It's like, if you can't sleep, if you're miserable, this is your life.
Yeah.
And thank you for that. I mean, thank you for that just beautiful, empowered approach to menopause? Because there's so much on the internet right now that is kind of fear-mongering around menopause that does concern me, actually. It's kind of like, this is dread, this is gloom. And it can feel terrible if you're not able to find resources to help. So speaking of, for those who are listening who are unfamiliar with the Women's Health Initiative, can you explain in a nutshell what it was, and we're going on 20 years since it was stopped, but what it was and what happened, what the controversy was? There was a before and there was an after, and then there's a now. So if we can talk about that progression, and I'd love to also then get to the now and talk about it. I mean, you must have had a little bit of whiplash, right? Like, okay, we got to stop this trial because this is so dangerous.
I remember it like it was yesterday because, all right, so give you a little background. Before the Women's Health Initiative was, before the report came out, which was in 2001. So now we're coming up on almost, you know, we're coming up on almost 23 years since that was reported. Okay, so I told you, hormones commercially available since 1942, Premarin was patented and women were, and we used hormones for the treatment of menopausal symptoms. We didn't know anything about disease prevention. It was like women who were miserable and had symptoms, we gave them hormones, they were treated, they felt better, great. Well, from about 1940s to about the 1970s or 80s, and they found out, wow, well, we weren't giving estrogen with progesterone. We were just giving estrogen by itself. And even though women felt great, the one thing that we found with all of this, you know, over these 30 or 40 years is that there was an increase in the risk of uterine cancer or endometrial cancer for women who took estrogen alone. So it's like, we fixed that problem by just realizing that you need to add progesterone or progestin to the estrogen. And that started probably in the 80s. So we're back on track now. Our estrogen, you know, relieves symptoms. We've taken care of the endometrial cancer problem. And then what changed the discussion about hormones just for treatment of symptoms was there was the nurses study where they actually just, it was an observational study where they looked at, you know, thousands of nurses and they followed them over time just to see, these are relatively healthy women, how do they do as they age? And they found that the nurses who were on hormone therapy had half the risk of heart disease of the women and the nurses who did not take hormone therapy. So that was an interesting hypothesis generator because it says, wow, well, if in addition to treating symptoms, women who are taking hormone therapy have half the risk of heart disease, that is groundbreaking. That is something that we really can affect the bottom line, not on just the quality of women's lives, but the quantity of their lives, because fewer women are going to die of heart disease. And a lot of women don't realize that heart disease is still, was then, and it's still now, the number one killer of women. So, the Women's Health Initiative that was initiated by the first woman who was the head of the NIH, Dr. Bernadine Healy, is said, well, let's construct a study that will prove that hormone therapy will decrease the risk of heart disease, and this will be, you know, seismic in terms of women's health. Well, the Women's Health Initiative, that was the reason why the study was designed, what the study was designed to answer that question, does it decrease the risk of heart disease? We didn't need a study to know whether or not it decreased the risk of menopausal symptoms. We had almost 50 years. We knew that. Well, the problem is this, it was in the initial design of the study, and it wasn't totally crazy, but it skewed the results. To be in the Women's Health Initiative, and this was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study, which means neither the doctor nor the women who were involved knew whether they were taking hormones or placebo, because that's the gold standard for being able to answer that question. Well, here's the problem. For women, you don't start to see the uptick in heart disease until they're about 10 years postmenopausal. Before menopause, women have half the risk of heart disease as men, but by the time they are 10 years postmenopausal, you start to see the rate for women approaches that of men. Okay, that's fact number one. So if you're going to design a study and it's only going to last for 8 years, you can't start, if you started at 50 and you finish at 58, Well, that's not enough time to know whether or not there's a difference in hormone users versus not. So they got the great idea of like, well, let's use older women because, and you could be anywhere from 50 to 79 to be in the study. You could be almost 80 years old because we want to see the difference in users versus non-users. And the other sort of design flaw was that they had to use women who were relatively asymptomatic. Because if you had hot flashes and mood swings and all the things about that we associate with menopause, how can you do a double-blind study? Because if I give you hormones and you had hot flashes and your hot flashes go away, you know whether you're on placebo or that. So they used relatively asymptomatic women. They were skewed to be much older so they could detect the heart disease decline if there were one. And these women were on average, more than 12 years beyond the time of when we would normally prescribe hormones. So therein lies the problem. So when 5 years in, when they held the Stop the Presses press conference to announce that there was no benefit in the decrease in the risk of heart disease, there was no benefit. But what I think what sealed the deal was that there was no benefit in heart, and there's a 26% increase in the risk of breast cancer.
Yeah. Boy, I remember that day. It really was a stop the presses day. We were all like, what do we do? What do we do?
And you remember, we didn't have the journal. We didn't have the article. So the press conference was held. They announced all these very incendiary findings. And we're there in the office. The phones are blowing up. And I can't even read the article to give patients any sort of guidance. And they were understandably distressed. They thought, oh my God, Dr. Malone, you've been telling me these things about how these great things that hormones are going to do, and it's going to kill me, and it's not giving me any benefit whatsoever. And I think here's the problem with the Women's Health Initiative. If they had reported their findings and just amended the little sentence that said, there is no decrease in the risk of heart disease if you start hormones more than 10 years after you've been menopausal or if you are more than 63 years old. And I think it does, again, doesn't take rocket science to know that if you're going to do a prevention study, you can't try to prevent heart disease in a 75-year-old who's already got heart disease, you know? And to further the misinterpretation of the study, when they didn't just apply it to the population studied, they applied it to all women. So women who were 50 or 48 who were starting hormones thought that those same findings applied to them. And that is, I think, what really led to a lot of the furor around the hormone issue. And when you added the increase in the risk of breast cancer on top of that, it was just the nail in the coffin. But let's just even talk about the breast cancer risk, because once you finally got to read the study and you say, well, 26% sounds like a lot, but you need to know what's the baseline? Because if I told you, if you bought my Lucky Charm, you're 26% more likely to win the lottery. Guess what? You're not going to win the lottery. Because the baseline, oh, it went from 1 in a billion to 1.26 in a billion. Well, that's 26%, but you're still not going to win. And the same thing is true of breast cancer. The baseline of women who got breast cancer without hormones was 30 per 10,000 women will get breast cancer a year just for living and having breasts. And with hormones, the women who were on hormones, it went from 30 to 38 per 10,000. So you're talking about fewer than 1 in 1,000 cases that were on top of whatever your baseline risk is. And that sounds a whole lot less scary than 26%. But even that is questionable. And that's beyond the scope of this right now. But even that number has been challenged on any number of different studies that have seen that even the 26% is not an accurate number. And that's only for women who took estrogen and progestin, not for women who took estrogen only, because the other part of that study that was not stopped was the women who took estrogen only. If you've had a hysterectomy, you don't need to take the progestin. And now with 20 years of look back, we have found that for women who took estrogen only, even in the older women, there has not only been a 23% decrease in the incidence of breast cancer, but a 40% decrease in the risk of dying from breast cancer. And there was no press conference to announce that. So, you know, that's sort of the history of why we got here and why there's been so many negative connotations about hormones without the understanding that there is a window of opportunity. It probably makes sense if you're going to get the most benefit from hormones, you should take them around the time of the natural menopause, not 10, 15, 20 years afterwards.
Great explanation, Sharon. So let's talk about where we're at now. We know that there are other protective effects, not some of the ones that we thought, but there are definitely protective effects. And let's talk about the window of opportunity. So when a woman comes to you with menopausal or perimenopausal symptoms, based on the guidelines, when do you feel like it is reasonable and appropriate to start menopausal replacement therapy? When should ideally a woman stop by, or how long is it safe to be on it for? And let's talk about the estrogen alone or estrogen progestin combinations.
Sure. Now, let me make this clear, is that the largest body of data that we have about hormones still comes from the Women's Health Initiative. Now, that has been sort of parsed. And what we have found, once you take out the women who are older, if you look at women who started hormones anywhere around the time of 50 to 60, those women get the most benefit from hormones, not only in just the relief of symptoms if you have them, even though that study wasn't designed for that, but you find that these women also have a decrease in the risk of heart disease. That thing that we saw with the women with the nurses study, it turns out that yes, but it matters. Timing matters of when you do this. But I also want to make very clear from the Women's Health Initiative, now this isn't speculation, this is what the largest study of estrogen in postmenopausal women has shown. What is it indicated for? Well, for women who take hormones, it is the only medication that has been shown to prevent osteoporosis. And I say prevent, not treat, because it matters, again, when you start taking it. Women who take estrogen will find that they have a decrease in the risk of hip fractures and vertebral fractures. That's huge. The other thing that hormones address really are what's called the genital urinary syndrome of menopause, which women will, even if you've had not one hot flash, over 80% of women will, in the course of their lives, have signs of the genital urinary syndrome of menopause. And what's that? Vaginal dryness, irritation, painful sex, urinary urgency, frequency, and frequent urinary tract infections. That can be quite bothersome. And if you don't believe it, just know that for elderly women, even in community-acquired infections, it is the number two reason why women are hospitalized and the number one reason why women are hospitalized in the nursing home population. I see preventing urinary tract infections by simple vaginal estrogen. It's everything, because it is no risk. Even whatever you believe about systemic hormones, just about anyone can use topical or vaginal estrogen for long-term vaginal and sexual health. So there's that. I think that the contraindications to taking hormones are actually quite few. And the North American Menopause sort of revised their guidelines in 2022. And the things that women take themselves out of the equation as to whether or not hormones would be a good fit for them, a big one is family history of breast cancer. Now, I have two sisters who've had breast cancer. That disturbs me not at all. And that was even before they came out with these guidelines, because what people don't realize is that breast cancer is a multifactorial disease, and there are many points at which we can intervene to decrease our risk. Taking hormone therapy after menopause, actually, the increase in the risk of breast cancer, that even if you believe that there is a risk, is attributable to the same risk as that if you drank two glasses of wine a day, or if you don't exercise, or if you are overweight. It's the same incremental amount of increase in the risk of breast cancer. So I say this to say all of these benefits that you get from hormones, it matters. Timing matters. The risk that got reported out of the Women's Health Initiative was really mainly in older women. And I think what scares women a lot is they also said, oh, it increases your risk of Alzheimer's. And that's even on the black box warning of even the lowest dose estrogen that is available, vaginal estrogen. That is simply not true. The only incidence in the slight increase that they had in strokes and Alzheimer's was for only seen in women who were over the age of 65 starting for the first time. So yes, timing matters. Now, is there a time at which it's too late? And I hate to say, we never say never in this business. There's always a risk-benefit ratio. If you are 62 and you are still having terrible hot flashes and disturbed sleep and all this, has the door closed for you? No, 60 is an arbitrary number. You can still have a discussion and weigh your risks, your benefits, and your risk tolerance. And this is something that really gets me going, is that I don't think that women should be told what they can and cannot have. I think that I can explain to you what those risk factors are, what your personal risk factors are, and then you can decide, because quality of life matters. And I can't think of another medication out there that there has been this much conversation for this long about the risks. We focus so much on the risks and we don't spend enough time on the benefits of hormone. And I think that any grown woman who gets that conversation can make a decision that's right for herself. And let me make this abundantly clear. There is no medication that you will take that does not have a risk and benefit profile. And the conversation around, no doctor talks to you for 30 minutes about what the risk of your high blood pressure medication is, or what your antidepressant risk is, or what your statin, all of them. But for whatever reason, there seems to be a particular energy around hormones that we just cannot get away from. And I have theories about why that's so, but I'll just leave you with this. We don't have this much conversation about testosterone in men. We don't have this conversation about Viagra for men. Viagra is a quality of life drug. There's no long-term health benefit of taking Viagra other than it'll just make you happier. But we don't have that same conversation. And why we minimize women's quality of life, why we minimize long-term women's health, it is a question for the books. And I mean, and maybe you can give me some insight into that.
I think there's so much politics and so much history there that we could have a whole day having that conversation. We need a conference on that conversation. You mentioned two glasses of wine and breast cancer risk, but that got me thinking about probably one of the biggest symptoms that I hear women talking about with menopause is sleep. And then along with the sleep does come the anxiety, the depression, the rage, and or the depression and anxiety can feed the sleep problems. So what are your thoughts on hormones for sleep or other approaches for sleep and some of these mood shifts that women are experiencing that really are directly related to being in perimenopause or menopause?
Well, you know, you and I have both been residents.
Oh, yeah.
And we know that you do not have to be perimenopausal to know what sleeplessness does to your mood and your productivity the next day.
And what you choose to eat, you know, the carb cravings, the extra coffee that then vicious cycle keeps you up, and the desire to have that glass of wine to relax, which just makes it worse.
Absolutely. And you and I both know, okay, so this is the sleep issue. Let's take it, sleep by itself. Women who have disrupted sleep or have poor quality sleep, what we know is that lack of sleep is an independent risk factor for cardiovascular disease, for mood disorders, for weight gain, for hypertension, across the board. Now, let's sort of peel that back. If the reason for your sleeplessness is hot flashes and night sweats are potent disruptors of women's sleep at night, well, you're kind of getting a bank shot here. Because if I take care of your hot flashes and your night sweats and you get a better night's sleep, you're going to necessarily improve all of those things, all those outcomes we just talked about. Now, if I told you that progesterone, and this has been shown in some cases, which is the second hormone that you use, not just estrogen. In some women, they find that progesterone actually makes them sleepy, and that's a good thing. But for the most part, I think the biggest impact that we're going to have is really getting rid of those pesky hot flashes. And getting back to hot flashes, this is another thing that women don't realize is that, you know, we have sort of minimized the hot flash and we laugh and get a fan. And
it's a big cardiovascular risk factor.
Yes, it is an independent risk factor for cardiovascular disease.
I call it a sixth vital sign of menopause.
Yes. And women, once you get treated for these things, and if I told you that bad sleep, mood, anxiety, brain fog, lack of productivity, all of those things are tied to your sleep cycle. And here is another interesting little tidbit that came from, there's a study, the SWAN study, of the study of women across the nation, where they just actually just followed women through the menopausal transition and beyond. So they have 25 years of data. And they found that, again, there's a black-white disparity in sleep. Black women have poorer quality of sleep, fewer hours, more disruption in their sleep, even when they don't complain of this. And they found this from sleep studies. And so all of those negative effects, and you mentioned this before, which is true, when you don't sleep well, you make poor choices the next day. You make poor dietary choices. So disrupted sleep also increases the risk of obesity. So, you know, when you think of who are the people who are most at risk, and Black women tend to have menopausal symptoms that start earlier, they last longer, on average 10 years, and they are more severe. These are women who are at most risk, but are least likely to get a discussion and a prescription for hormone therapy, even when indicated. And because of this fear factor, even when they get a prescription, they're only half as likely to take it. And something that you mentioned earlier that I do want to get back to is that, is there a time limit? You know, it's like, oh, well, I can only take for 5 years, or I can only take for 10. And that guidance that came out, I think, in the wake of the Women's Health Initiative, it was sort of a compromise between, oh, hormones are bad, don't ever take them at all. It was the compromise of saying, well, if you must take them, take the smallest amount for the least amount of time. And just understand, that's based on no science. So I don't know where they got that from. They just kind of pulled it out of the air. But there is no science that says that. And particularly for things like symptom relief, and there are women who will have symptoms for decades, women who are at risk for osteoporosis. The reason for continuing, not just for a few years, but forever, when you stop taking the hormones, your bone density will start to decrease. You'll start to lose bone at the same rate you would have lost had you not taken hormones at all. And so that's why it depends. Women can take for as long as they like. And as long as you don't have any of the contraindications for hormone therapy, if you haven't been diagnosed with something that requires that you stop, you can take hormone therapy for as long as your quality of life and the things that you are at risk for are still present, take it forever. So no, there is no time limit on how long a person can take hormone therapy.
Sharon, part of the menopausal movement that we're seeing right now, which is wonderful and powerful and incredible, has a little bit of a potential shadow side in that clearly the medical and the wellness industry has recognized and described menopause as a cash cow and a gold rush. What guidance or thoughts do you have for women who are trying to navigate the menopause space to make sure that the information and solutions they're getting are sound? I mean, even in my own social media feed, because I'm in women's health, I get no end of ads for this supplement or that practice or this thing to reduce muffin tops in menopause or all the things. So it feels like women are a little bit vulnerable to this medical and wellness misinformation and overmarketing right now.
That's a problem. Just because we have access to data does not mean we have access to information. And a lot of what's out there, I say do a little homework, because everything that I talk about is based on, and let's be entirely clear about this, it is based upon the best data that we have available historically and even for the things that have come out currently. Now, when you were talking about supplements and, all right, I'm going to go ahead and say it. Consider the source. You know, there are people who are great actresses and models and all of that, but what gives them the authority to tell me what supplements I can take or whatever? Because usually you're rich and famous. You have a lot of things that are going to, you know, keep you healthier than what vitamin or supplement you take. So just bear in mind that there are some supplements that are beneficial, like you should take the minimum daily requirement of calcium and vitamin D. You should take fiber. There are things that are beneficial, but be careful about things that make outlandish claims.
If it's too good to be true, it's too good to be true.
That's true. It's either not that good or it's not true. But I say, just do a little bit and say, well, if someone is selling you a supplement that says your memory is going to improve and now, you know, this is an Alzheimer's backer, just take a minute and Google it and say, where's the data? Where's the study? And here's a little bit of just always a good rule of thumb is that if you are buying a supplement, it costs more than you would spend on a beautiful night's out or whatever, or a beautiful dinner, you're probably paying too much for that supplement. And likewise, if you are taking a supplement and it requires 12 to 15 tablets a day, you're always going to be better off of using that money to eat good whole food, because supplements are meant to just supplement the things that you don't get in your diet. You want to improve your brain health? Well, how about this? Exercise, eat a healthy diet, don't drink alcohol. You know, for women, and I think that there is, and again, I want to be very clear about this, there is considerable evidence that is pointing in the direction that hormones do play a role in women's brain health.
Yes, who's often getting significant affiliate commissions from these products. You say in your book that it's not a medical activism book designed to fight the power. It's a book designed to show women the power they already have. And I love that. And you say it's to also increase our capacity and willingness to use it. And it's a book about breaking silences, which you're just doing such a beautiful job of. So many women go to their primary care provider, their gynecologist, or whoever their physician is, and are really struggling to get the support they need. How do you encourage women to find and use their power and their voices?
Well, you know, the more you know, the better advocate you can be for yourself. And that was really the point of my book. I wasn't trying to write a book that makes you be a doctor. I'm writing a book so to make you aware of the things that you should know and the questions you should ask when you go in. How do I approach this system? Because I am not doctor bashing. I practiced for years, so I know that the pressure that doctors are under, and that pressure is getting worse as time goes on, because the amount of time that doctors have with patients is getting less and less and less, and there's less continuity of care. So we have to deal with the reality that most healthcare providers, physicians, nurses, nurse practitioners that you interact with are not going to know you. You know, they don't know how to answer a question specifically for you. They know how to answer a question generally for the general population. So that's why you have to advocate for yourself and know the things that you need to ask. And let me say, it's going to require, again, a little bit of effort on your part, but understand that you deserve to get the answers to the questions that you didn't even know to ask. And I'm going to give you those questions. So when you go into that interaction, you are ready. Because let me just say this, doctors are under, I mean, I know they're shouldering a big burden right now. And we are also facing a doctor shortage. And that's the other part of this reality. The population is aging faster than we can provide doctors and healthcare professionals to address these things. So it's not a lot. You don't have to go to medical school. It's some basic things. And I want you to understand is that you come into this interaction, nobody knows you better than you. So take that in, get your little pen and pad, and make sure you know how to be efficient and effective at advocating for yourself, for your family members, for your parents, and for your children. You can do this, And let me just say, there is going to be a whole other sort of evolution of what's happening in doctor-patient relationships. You know, there's going to be a lot of artificial intelligence involved. And so, again, know that that's not bad. It's just the new world order. And you need to know that so you can be a better advocate.
And get personalized care, right? Not just algorithmic care. Sharon, before I ask you the final question that I love to ask all my guests, if you don't mind, I want to address just one potential elephant in the room, only because my audience is an educated, researchy lot. And I just want to make sure that we're addressing the fact that you have a relationship to Alloy, which does promote and sell or make access to hormones available. And knowing you and knowing your work, I don't question the integrity of that. And my assessment has been you're part of that because you think it's so important for women to have access. But can you just address how you integrate or when you're teaching potential questions of conflict of interest there?
Absolutely. And let me say this. I had been practicing for 30 years, and when I left my practice, I didn't leave my practice to join Alloy. I was done. I was like, okay, good. That's a, you know, this seems like a good stopping point in my career. And when I found them, and I talked to Anne and Monica, who were the founders, and I had no reason to do anything other than this is something that I felt is the right thing to do. As I said, I've been treating women for menopause and have been steeped in this world for over 30 years. I am not for sale, and I would not promote or talk about anything that I did not believe, in my best clinical judgment, is the right thing to do. And we sort of came to this because I realized, and I say this all the time, if you have a doctor who knows what they're doing, who treats menopause, and you are getting the care you need, that's where you need to be. Unfortunately, that is not the reality for most women. And I realized that on a one-on-one basis, there are just only so many patients I can see in the course of the day, even if I wanted to do nothing but menopause. And I think that this is where you leverage technology, which is what I love about young people, is that they realize that you can, in a telehealth environment, leverage the expertise of a few people over thousands of women. And so ultimately, we are trying to fix the access problem. So for women out there who don't have practitioners and don't have people who are being gatekept out of hormone therapy, this is for you. And would I sell you nonsense? No, because I do say this, and I mean it. I'm in this business not to sell you something. I'm here to tell you something. And I think that once you have the information, you are more than capable of making the decision for yourself. So that's not my job to sell you on anything. My job is to give you the information. You have it. I give you the best science that's available. And I think that we've done a really good job at that. And you decide. And that gets back to the same mission about why I wrote the book. I want to sort of change this locus of control from medical gatekeepers to individual women. You read it, you decide it. Is this a good decision for you? But then to do that, I also have to give you access. And that's why my relationship with Alloy works the way it is, because they know and I know that I'm not going to promote anything that I don't firmly believe in, and not just from belief, from a scientific basis.
Now, there's some powerful things happening on the internet with women democratizing access to information, which is what I do, and access to resources, as you say, which we've talked about from birth to menopause, cradle to grave, are withheld. Okay, to my question. We're talking about really just the power of being in these years that we're in. But I'm always curious, if you could tell your younger self one thing, one piece of guidance or wisdom, what age would she be and what would you tell her?
You know what? I thought about this. It's funny because not even thinking that you would ask me this question, I thought about what I would tell my younger self is that it's okay to live my life and to make decisions that put me first. And particularly that comes up because I was talking to my husband just recently and I said, God bless these young women who are out here, particularly in medicine and who are working, who are not asking, they are demanding, particularly when it comes to postpartum care. They are saying, why am I going back to work in 6 weeks? I have a newborn. I'm not healed. I'm not ready to go back to work. We have tried to fit the male model of work onto our female needs and healthcare decisions. And I think if I had to do anything over again, I would tell myself, girl, take 3 months off. Why are you running back to work at 6 weeks? Because I didn't even think it was an option not to. So my advice to the younger me would say, it's not that important. As we say, no one ever dies at their desk and says, oh, I wish I had been at work more. Never. It's okay to put you first.
Sharon, you are beautiful and brilliant and wise and a change maker. It is truly a privilege to have this conversation with you. I look forward to knowing you more and over much more time. And thank you for your book. I mean, even the title, Grown Woman Talk, I'm going to show it in case we ever have this on video. Thank you so much for all you do, everybody. Really, whatever age you're at, it's never too early to learn about all the life cycles, because just like Sharon was saying, how we go into pregnancy can determine so much of our health. How we are in our 30s, our 40s can determine so much of our health experience in our 50s and our 60s and beyond. And that is a quarter of our life. So everyone, Grown Woman Talk with Sharon Malone. Thank you, Sharon, so much. And everyone, I'll see you next time. Got me down, gonna lift it up. I hope you enjoyed this episode, that it helped you to feel seen and heard, and perhaps that it even brought you some aha moments. Please share the love by sharing this with a friend or someone in your life who could benefit from the kinds of things we talk about in this space. Also, make sure to follow me on Instagram at dr.avivaram. And go to avivaram.com to join the conversation about the show on my blog. While you're there, you can sign up for my free newsletter with tips on taking back your health. Be sure to leave a rating and a review for the podcast and follow the podcast to be notified of new episodes every week. Can't wait to see you next time.